surpass having trade in perfect truth. Even in 100,000 years, help us. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself.
Homage to the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. In the last 2 or 3 days, I've been talking a lot about discipleship and the master-disciple relationship. And today I want to say some things about lay discipleship in particular. We've been reflecting a good deal on this subject in our temple, and Reverend Master Mokshin in particular, I found to have very deep insight and helpful observations on this subject. Also, I know Reverend Master Hector, who I talk with on a weekly basis, and Reverend Master Olaf, Reverend Master Clement. I've been speaking with all of these people, sometimes with Reverend Master Basil. You know, we all started as disciples. We didn't become masters overnight. Nonetheless, when most of us started our training, Reverend Master was not talking about formal lay discipleship. And indeed, it's not until the last years of her life that lay trainees actually started to ask of senior monks that they might have a formal relationship of discipleship to them. That doesn't mean that many people did not have this in their hearts. But to formalize it and have it in your hearts are obviously a little bit different. After Reverend Master's death, when then there were, you might say, more masters to choose from in a certain sense. Reverend Master's transmission is carried by many people, whereas Koho Zenji's transmission to us came through Reverend Master Jiu. Koho Zenji had other transmitted disciples, but who themselves have had disciples and grand disciples and so on, I'm sure, by now. Nonetheless, for us, in our little branch of Sangha, as Reverend Master Jiu's monastic disciples, after her death, you know, it's not surprising that lay trainees to start looking for a master in the way we look to Reverend Master as a master. Even if it is formalized in some way, lay discipleship is of necessity very different in some ways from monastic discipleship. Monks typically train with their master most of the time for the first years of their training, perhaps for their whole lives, or until their master dies or they die, often for many years. I would say that in general, a monastic disciple who has not had an opportunity to train with their master full-time, doing full-time training with their master for at least 5 years, has in some ways been deprived, I think. And I think that really the greater benefits often happen after many more years than that. Of course, discipleship does not end if one goes far away and starts a temple of one's own. It's just that there's a geographical separation, not a separation of the heart. And not a separation in the sense of one has not ceased to be a disciple because one is no longer with the master. Well, anyway, lay trainees do not train typically with their master at those close quarters, year in and year out, day in and day out. And this is a considerable difference. Many monastic disciples, very sincere people, fall away in the early years of being at close quarters with their master. You know, and for that matter with the other monks. But for a disciple, the ultimate human authority, spiritually, resides in the master. Again, the master is not the eternal, and the master stands in the place of the eternal in the early years of one's training, and the master represents the eternal to some extent always for a disciple. Rebbe Master's been dead for over 20 years, 21 years now. For me, she still represents the eternal. When I have something I really need to knuckle down to and really ask the eternal's help for, I come to the Founder's Shrine. I look Rebbe Master's little icon right in the eye, say, please help me. And do bows. I have dreamt, had dreams about Rebbe Master ever since she died. I don't remember dreaming about her except once, before she died. But ever since she died, I dream of her now and then. Sometimes when I dream of her, she's upset at me. Sometimes when I dream of her, she's comforting me. Sometimes she's just there in some way. I just think the Eternal uses the Master in so many ways to help the disciple. And that representation is a major way. Representing itself through a human being. Few lay trainees ever train with a master at such close quarters that such demands are put upon them as the monks go through experience. Younger lay trainees, I have come to think, you know, newer lay trainees should not be accepted as monastic disciples, as lay disciples in a formal sense. I think now that anyone who has not done Jukai should not be accepted as a disciple formally by a master. I think people in the earlier years of their lay training simply have no concept of what they're getting into if they become a disciple. I've seen this in some of my lay disciples. Generally, those who I took who were greener have fallen away now. The more seasoned lay trainees, those who have had a lot of experience of training, that is not the case with them, generally speaking. They had a much better idea of what of the meaning of what they were getting into. But I have to say that after Rebbe Master's death, and when lay trainees started to come to us, various monks who Rebbe Master had named masters in her lifetime, to ask to be lay disciples, Rebbe Master had not left us any protocol. Zero. We had to kind of work it out as a kind of fly by the seat of your pants. And I think now that in the Serene Reflection Dharma Association, of which this temple is a member, and of which Rebbe Master Mokshin is the dean or the head of the association, we are now starting to reflect on applying some more formal requirements, both for the help of the masters and the disciple. Let me talk a few minutes about the gravity, the seriousness of the nature of the commitment of discipleship. And to some degree or other, this applies to everyone who asks to be a disciple and is accepted. It applies to both, in its own way, to both master and disciple. Hopefully the master will have a much better idea of the gravity of what the person has asked for and what they, the master, grant when they accept a disciple than any lay trainee could have. But everyone who makes this request, I always assume that it's utterly sincere. I never query it. I never doubt it. And if it is such a sincere request, you have to consider, if you have made such a request, or you're thinking making such a request, or you have made a request, had someone make such a request to you as a master, and you're sitting on whether to accept that person or not, you have to take that seriousness of intent seriously yourself. As the person who has made that request, when things get difficult, when the master turns out not to be the person you thought they were, when they give you teaching that you do not like, you do not even understand, and it does not seem fair maybe at all, are you going to then say, oh, well, you know, at the moment that I made that request, that was serious, yes, insincere. But now things have changed, and I'm not bound by that anymore. Let's do a little comparison. Think about marriage for a moment. Think about people who have done marriage in the fullest sense and made, you know, genuine marriage vows in church with a minister or priest presiding. And in the context of a religion where making a vow means something. It's not just a formality. Think about how hard it is for those people to divorce one another. Anyone who takes marriage casually doesn't understand what marriage is. Anyone who takes discipleship casually doesn't understand what discipleship is. Perhaps someone that deluded and ignorant is in some way shielded, very, you know, protected by that delusion and ignorance. Anyone who believes that they themselves are not that deluded and ignorant had better darn well be sure that if they've made such a request and been accepted, that they are taking it seriously all the time, and that they never go along with that little thing in their mind that says, well, so-and-so, my master, after all, doesn't know beans. And in this case, I can just ignore them. One thing I found in my relationship with her master was that I literally could never simply discount any teaching she gave me. I could never write it off. I've told this story before. I'll tell it here because it's such a great example of this in my own experience. They had a dog at the Abbey that was not fitting in and that was fighting with some of the other dogs, one in particular, which happened to be her master's dog, and had just bitten someone, a monk, in a very dangerous spot, bit her right in the face. I happened to come down to the Abbey just after this bite happened, and her master, I was sitting alone with her master, and her master was telling me about this, and she just looked at me, and she said, maybe there's something you can think of. Or would it be possible you could take him? Something along those lines. Clearly, whether it's either implied or explicitly stated, can you take this dog off my hands? She knew I loved dogs and that dogs gravitate towards me and I tend to accept them. I think that's a particular kind of karma from killing a lot of animals, I think. I get a chance to love animals in this lifetime where earlier I hurt a lot of animals. Well, it was just written Basil and me, and he was a layperson at the time in the monastery. And we had two dogs at the time, I believe. Because we had up to five dogs here at times in the early years. It's hard for me to remember. I think we had two at the time, and we just had a new dog that had been abandoned out here and that we'd taken in, a German Shepherd lady. And she was still just getting adjusted to being here. And I said to her master, I said, "I'm sorry, I just don't think we could take it." And her master said, "That's fine, we'll find another way." The next morning, in meditation, in the meditation hall, I was sitting there along with all the other monks, and I hadn't been sitting there more than a few minutes, and it just hit me like a blow. You cannot simply say that to your master without having actually really meditated on it and seen, is there something you can do? And as soon as I had that thought, my heart just kind of opened, I saw the answer. Trade lady for the dog that was the problem. So I called Rim Basil that morning and said, because the lady was living with him, and we both loved the lady, although we hadn't had her long, and I asked him, would you be willing to part with her and we take on another dog because of this situation? And as he has so often done, he just said unconditionally yes. So I went to Rim Master as soon as I could, and I just laid it out. I said, we'll trade. Well, after that, I had the jitters really bad because this dog had just bitten someone really severely, and all the monks were telling me what a disaster this dog was in the community. I was afraid, what's going to happen with us up there? Is he going to bite the neighbors? Is he going to kill our other dogs? Well, Rim Master Daishin, who had the dog at the time, Daishin Yalin, came up with me in the car, and the dog came with us. It was a 500-mile drive from the Abbey to here. I got in the driver's seat. The dog was in the back of the car. Before I knew it, he'd come up and he licked me on the ear. And I knew, there's no problem here. And there never was. And he lived with me for about 12 or 13 years with us. And I don't say we never had any problems. He was a handful, but he was a dog we all loved deeply. A rather long-winded story, I'm afraid, but it exemplifies the point I'm making. Whether you're a lay disciple or monastic disciple, if you don't understand discipleship in the way I'm describing in that story, you do not understand discipleship. It's that simple, it really is. You never can write off your master. If your master's in a bad temper, if your master's exhausted, worn out, and confused, if your master's sick, if your master's crazy, it doesn't matter. You cannot write him off. What about helping him if they're having difficulty? That's the way a true disciple thinks. What about not making it worse than it already is? For myself, I'm not taking on any more lay disciples. Not that I have a great line of them lined up there asking me, but I wouldn't take on any more lay disciples without doing a formal lay ordination ceremony, whether they'd done a lay ordination ceremony at a Jikai ceremony or not, or with me or not. I would do another lay ordination ceremony. And I would put in something that was probably a little different than the monastic ceremony, in which it kind of drums home the nature of the commitment made by a lay trainee in becoming a lay disciple. I would also put certain requirements on a lay person wherever they live, even if it's 100 miles away, as to they're coming to train with me in my temple. You train in the temple, by the way, you might not see me most of the time. Or sometimes you might not see me ever, if I happen to be ill. But I would say, as long as you're physically able, you will come here and train with me periodically, say at least twice a year, something like that, for some substantial period of time, at least say a week, something like that. I have no such requirement on any lay disciple I have now. I'm not going to say, now you have to live up to this, because that's not part of the deal that we had at the time. But that's what I would require from now on. Because of a really bad experience, it's been a great teaching experience for me, and I'm grateful for it, and a very difficult situation with a couple of lay disciples who had really no concept of what they really had got into, and who could and would not, I think they're capable of it, but would not accept teaching that asked them to make some serious changes. Which brings up another point, that is that any lay trainees who undertake the commitment of lay discipleship, who think that they can live their life in the world without adhering to the teachings of Buddhism and without adhering to the teachings of their master, simply because they are a lay person different than a monk, has no business being a lay disciple, has no concept of lay discipleship. Leaving the gate of the monastery, the door of the monastery, and going back into the world is not some kind of carte blanche to go do something utterly irresponsible and non-perceptual. Lay disciples, obviously, no lay trainee has any business trying to set themselves as some kind of self-appointed religious teacher simply because for any reason whatsoever. Being a lay disciple does not constitute being a religious teacher in any way, shape, or form. Although a master can delegate certain responsibilities that can come under the very general heading of teaching to a lay trainee, and masters frequently do so with senior lay trainees. And in my experience, senior lay trainees to whom those responsibilities are delegated always do an excellent job and a very conscientious job. We all rely upon such people, more senior lay trainees in our temples. We all, meaning the monks. But for that matter, all the congregation looked to those people for help in example and in just understanding what's going on. These lessons I'm speaking of, I think the context in which I'm speaking should make it clear that in the way in which I'm speaking, that these are hard lessons that have been learned, some of them in the school of hard knocks, you might say. And that's frequently the case in our training, that we have to learn things in the school of hard knocks. Nothing else sometimes gets through. And even though at the time one finds these things difficult to go through, I find for myself, I always really work at bowing in the midst of it and reminding myself that everything that happens is for my good. And I always find over time that it's from these very difficult situations that I learn the most. The last thing I want to say elaborates on a point I've made briefly in this talk, that lay disciples can help their masters. Help is not a one-way street, and it certainly is always helpful when lay congregation, lay disciples actually provide support for the temple, for the monks. And I'm certainly including that kind of help in what I'm saying, but for the purposes of this talk, I want to talk a little bit about other kinds of expressions of generosity to the monks, and in particular to the master, that lay disciples can offer. First and foremost is simply one's faith. I have some lay disciples who have been my lay disciples for many years now and who have witnessed from a bit of a distance compared to my monastic disciples, but still have witnessed at times the price that I as a master and as an abbot of a temple sometimes pay for just doing the job. Not that I do the job in some super exemplary way. Most of the time I feel like I'm kind of muddling along and just barely managing. Yet I have disciples who have, I have one disciple who said to me a number of times, whatever has happened, I have never doubted you. And when I spoke the other day about a kind of trust and faith that disciples show that I find simply awesome, this is one example of it. In fact, this is for me the single prime example in my experience that someone who's been with me, training with me for over 30 years now, could say that to me. I find that amazing. I cannot say that of myself. I cannot say I have never doubted myself. I have doubted myself many times. That person is seeing the Buddha in another human being. And that person is not a fool and does not think that I'm in any way superhuman. She knows me as a human being very well as her master. And she accepts it. So for me, this individual has been for many years the exemplary lay disciple. And during a recent illness of this individual, I'm telling you, I was sweating it. I cannot say how much it would grieve me to lose that person. Another way that lay disciples can help their master is just by showing up. If they live locally, come regularly to scheduled temple events. You'll participate. If they live far away, you'll come as frequently as possible. People often think that it's only helping me. This master doesn't need any help. Well, leaving any spiritual consideration aside, there's in every monastery that's functioning properly, there's always way more work to do than the monks can do. And that's always been the case here. Expects of senior lay trainees that they will think not just of what they get out of it, but what they can offer someone else, especially their master. Room Master used to speak, when I was a young monk, she was speaking constantly of having compassion for the abbot. Well, in that case, the abbot and the master were the same thing. We were all her disciples. She was not saying that any more than I am here because she was feeling a lack of support or trust from people. Or because she felt any particular need for people to express in any particular way their trust or love. As she said in Zen's Eternal Life, and it is really true, the true master is beyond praise and blame. Doesn't mean they don't feel the pain of blame. It doesn't mean they don't feel pleasure at praise. But it means they know there's more to life than that, and that those are unrealities, and that they fundamentally don't matter. They don't base their actions, their decisions, on the basis of such transitory, ephemeral, and meaningless things. Love and devotion, compassion for someone who you look to as representing the eternal for you, and is the primary source of human teaching to you. I mean, the thing that people ought to ask themselves is what does this mean to me that I exhibit this in my life, that I manifest this in my training, or that I do not do so? There is such a thing, as I've mentioned earlier in these talks, as a sin of omission. Simply failing to do that which is good to do for self and others is in some ways the most dangerous kind of mistake, because people think, I didn't do anything, so there's no consequences. How could there be consequences? I didn't do anything. There are always consequences. When one does not do that which is good to do, there are consequences, just as much as when one does do that which is not good to do. In conclusion, what I'd like to say is that I would not want to be the one to underestimate or in any way undervalue the depth of love and trust and respect that can exist between a lay disciple and their monastic master. love is love, whether it be for a flower, an animal, a tree, a human being, male, female, fat, thin, tall, short, monk, lay trainee, disciple, congregation member who is not a formal disciple, so on and so forth. Love is love. At the deepest level, trust is trust. What is it ultimately in one another that we are trusting? What is it that flows between us when love manifests so exquisitely? It is the eternal itself, the great immaculacy. And what exists between master and disciple at the very heart of that relationship is so utterly pure and so exquisite. There's something that carries on into future lifetimes. As I myself know, because I had a past life where I was a disciple of her master. Of course, it wasn't me and it wasn't her. But I had a previous past life in which I was a devoted disciple of the person who her master Jiu got her karma from, some of her karma from. And I have that same devotion now and have had for many, many years from my master. And as a master, I have that same devotion to my disciples, whether they be lay or monk.
Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to this scripture of great wisdom.